members in a grant from the Garden Spout specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. Also by One Green World, a nursery offering hard-to-find fruiting plants designed to help you grow your own food and decorate your yard, deck, or patio. Now located in Portland at 6469 Southeast 134th. For a color catalog, the number is 1-877-353-4028 or online at onegreenworld.com. And also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Here comes the dirt bag.
Good morning. We've reached the second Wednesday of the month. It's time for the Dirt Bag. This is Glenn Andreessen here beside you now until 12 noon. Normally, Jim would be with me, but he's not here yet. He's coming. Although I believe he will not be here next month, so he should be here. But we've got a pretty good show lined up for you today. Kind of an interesting plant of the month. Moss, and I'll tell you kind of how that plays into my thinking here. Here's Mr. Jim right now. traffic, he says. Okay, so I need to read this disclaimer here now that guest Jim Gilbert of One Green World, full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program. There he is. Oh, man, look what Jim brought with it. All is forgiven. He has a plate of, it looks like, Desert King figs. That's what they are. Okay. Well, we'll talk about pears. Finally, this is kind of pear month here, and we talk about harvesting and ripening, storage, all of that. We also have these ticket giveaways. And like we've been doing for the last few months here to the Portland Eco Film Festival, the film is Above All Else. The screening will be Thursday, August 21st at 7:30. Is that a week from... It is. It is a week from this Thursday, so 9 days away. Above All Else, let me read this to you. It's an intimate portrait of a group of landowners and activists in East Texas who tried to stop the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, a $7 billion project slated to carry tar sands oil from Canada to Texas Gulf Coast refineries. Risking financial ruin, personal safety, and family security, these people's stories of resistance and direct action explore the human spirit and how social change happens in America. Post-film panel question and answer with film director John Feige, F-I-E-G-E. Sorry, I didn't get that one ahead of time. So we'll have three pairs of tickets to give away, so we'll come up with some stumpers. I have some ideas. I'm hoping Jim has some, too, there. Hey, by the way, welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Glenn. Nice to see you. Sorry, you're right on time, just right exactly. I was really watching that clock and thinking, man, can I get there?
But okay, so that will be coming up. Then we'll talk about, things that we can harvest now or things that we are harvesting now, maybe some tips on picking at their peak. And as usual, we will talk about what's going on in the honeybee hive if we have time. But we always have time for your questions. 503-231-8187. That's also the number that you'll call when we do some garden stumping.
Well, we have actually fruit to talk about besides pears, which is, you know, I mean, there's a lot going on right now. Not only were we harvesting, we're just sort of at the end of fig season, and Desert King figs, which I brought to you today, are there's really at the end, at least here in the valley. I mean, I suspect cooler areas they could still be ripening, but we're pretty much done.
I'm done.
Yeah. It's been an early year.
Yes.
It's been warm temperatures, so things have been ripening, I would say, a week to 2 weeks ahead of schedule
in the past. Mm-hmm. Well, there's no normal weather, just average weather.
Yeah, right. Okay. And sea berries, we're in the middle of sea berry harvest. On the end of the Russian sea berries and the beginning of the German ones. And that's pretty much fun. In fact, I was having a conversation on Bluetooth on the way up here with a juice processing company as we attempt to figure out a way to get sea berry juice into the market. It's a pretty exciting project that we're working on. And peaches, we finished the Oregon curl free and anxiously awaiting Krybich nectarine right now. Good trees are loaded. This really has been an amazing year for some fruit.
Well, tell me about the Oregon curl free. Was it this year?
Yes.
Free of curl?
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. You always get, maybe, or not always, but most of the time get,
you know,
some.
Yeah, a couple leaves here and there maybe, but it's amazingly resistant. It's really excellent variety for us. And along with Q18, which is this one, I think it's getting renamed, but I haven't heard the new name. It came out of Washington many years ago. So Oregon curl free is a yellow fleshed peach. And Q18 is white-fleshed, and both very good.
You know, I can understand why they'd want to rename it.
Yeah.
Q18.
Yep, must have been in row Q.
Right. Number 18.
Number 18, perhaps, right. Yeah.
Well, there's kind of some nostalgia there, if that's the case. Okay, well, we'll talk about all of that there, and that'll take us to noon, at least. So, any events happening?
Well, we just had the real big event here, which was the NAFEX meeting.
Oh, that's right.
Right, and that was just last week. So,
well, I was gone.
Yeah,
it's down there at the Scandinavian Festival there, Jim,
That's Junction City.
Yeah, I had a good time there.
I got to come down there one of these years and check that out. So that was fun. I mean, the people from all over the country came, and fruit nuts, you know, we're gathering here in our area. I was out at Edgefield was where the main thing was. I gave a talk on some of my exploring journeys. I had a half an hour to talk about 11 time zones from Eastern to Western Russia. That was kind of a hurried discussion, but covered some interesting topics.
What did you learn? Did you learn anything new? Tell me one thing you learned new.
That's a really good question, Glenn. Give me a moment. I'll think about that one.
All right. With the right answer, you might win a pair of tickets.
Right. Sadly, as I said to my partner, Lorraine, I said, I wish they held this event in a different place because we were going back and forth to work and the phone, you know, it was like we weren't escaping our duties at the nursery.
So yeah. If it had been a little further away.
Yeah, we could have like really relaxed. But.
Right. Well, we'll get right in then to the plant of the month here. And, you know, I said that our plant of the month is moss. Well, what are we going to talk about moss for? Well, it's just an end run, just to get your attention. You know, why would we talk about moss? Well, mostly it's to talk about an attractant for insects. Moss attracts insects? No, but when moss is wet, it does. And so what I do, and I advocate for beekeepers and just homeowners in general, is to have a water source out for insects. And of course, if you don't have moss in your water source, then you'll also attract birds. But most insects are not good swimmers. And if they land in the middle of a deep puddle, then they'll drown, particularly honeybees. Other insects can kind of walk on water, if you will, or at least paddle to the edge. But honeybees will drown pretty well. So I discovered this some 20 years ago when I had a tray of vegetable starts out that they were just leftovers. They didn't make it out into the ground, but I just left them. You know, I didn't want to kill them prematurely. Well, I might need this down the line to replace something, but they get too big and root-bound and whatnot. But in the meantime, I'm watering them, and moss starts growing on the surface. When you always have a wet surface, moss will grow there just naturally. I don't know where it came from, flew in from the air, spores or whatnot. And I would start noticing that there'd just be dozens of bees and other insects landing on this moss, sticking their tongues out, their proboscis, and just sucking up the water. Now, I normally see bees and wasps on the moss bed. The Lepidoptera, the butterflies and moths, I never see them on the moss because they have relatively long proboscis, and they can unfurl that and sip water from many different sources. But bees, in fact, I never see bumblebees on my moss beds either. But boy, the honeybees are there by, maybe a foot square or maybe 2 feet square, even have a tray. Sometimes it's not an exaggeration to think that there might be, I've never really counted them, but 80 to 100 bees on this moss. If you want to have better pest control and better pollination, it's a good idea to attract these insects to your garden. So why not? And it's a good way. It's kind of like the equivalent of a bird feeder. The birds don't really need our seeds for the most part, but it's a way to get them up close so you can observe them and see how they function. Same with this is the same idea, just getting these insects up close so you can appreciate what they look like and what they do. Mm-hmm. It's not hard to attract 4, 5, 6 different species of insects on these trays or whatever you might put out. And, it could be pebbles or something like that, too, in your rocks. But moss seems to be great.
And where do you find this moss?
It finds itself on its way in. But oftentimes, I'll transplant some if I want to start another one where I find it on growing on dirt. Hmm. Not necessarily in the lawn, although that might work, too. And I'm no moss expert. I'm not even a moss novice. I know, that's moss, but there's probably 3 or 4 species of moss growing in there now, mm-hmm. too, which in itself is kind of fun.
Yeah,
it's green if you keep it watered. And I just flood it. Mm-hmm. Every day when it's hot, I might have to fill up my moss bed, maybe twice.
It doesn't float. It's sitting...
That's correct. They're in dirt. They're still in these 6-pack trays. Hmm. But it's just one mound of moss covering up, half a dozen 6-pack trays. Maybe there's probably more, 20 of them, or 6 or 8, these little 6-packs.
6-pack trays, you mean like pots?
Little vegetable trays, okay. Very small, just inch right. across.
And there's no free water sitting on the surface. It's just underneath the moss. Is that right?
The water?
Yeah.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Well, the moss is above the level.
Right.
And sometimes the bees will crawl down on the sides where there is just free water. But most of them are landing right on the moss, cooling their feet in the meantime.
Wow. Yeah. Neat. Huh.
So it's a great way. In fact, here in the city of Portland, we need permits to keep bees in the city. Ostensibly, you need a permit. And when I got my permit, the only question that the inspector asked was, where's your water source? Because bees will find any source of water. And they need water. And this is going to be part of the stumper. Why do honeybees need water? In fact, I have 3 answers here. And all you have to do is come up with one and you'll get a pair of tickets. Let's go ahead and open the phones now. We don't need to play the theme right now. But so if you can tell me one reason why honeybees need water, or how they use water, let's put it that way, we'll put your name on the guest list for a pair of tickets at the Portland Ecofilm Series, above all else, for the August 21st showing. 503-231-8187 there. I was going somewhere with that before I went with the stumper.
Yeah, bees and water.
Let's just play Muddy Water right now. This is a great song by Lou Rawls. I'd rather drink muddy water. I mean, this is, I'm going to, after this, we'll talk about the how this relates to insects, but that's why it does. Lou Rawls.
Got to have our little talk. I ought to pack up my things and walk. I know a dollar goes from hand to hand, but before I let you go from man to man, I'd rather drink muddy water, sleep out in a hollow log. I work for you like a Georgia mule. My friends all laughed, call me a fool. Your kisses are sweet as can be, but before I'll let you make a fool out of me, I'd rather drink muddy water, lay down and sleep in a hollow log. I love you, baby, but you won't be fair. You don't know how to be on the square. Have your fun, baby, if you must, but before I'll have a woman that I cannot trust, I'd rather drink muddy water, sleep out in a hollow log, muddy water.
Oh, it's hard to cut into that one, but cut in we must. Lou Rawls, I'd rather drink muddy water. Well, I hardly see any of the Lepidoptera, the moths and butterflies. They frequently will drink from muddy water. That was a great segue, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect.
And because they can gather up minerals from that. And particularly it's the males that will be drinking the muddy water to get the minerals, because they will use them to grow themselves, and particularly to it gets concentrated or at least transferred in their sperm. So when they mate with the females are picking up some of these nutrients there too. So muddy water, that's, you know, oftentimes when I'm out hiking, I'll see lots of butterflies on parts of the muddy trails if it's been raining or if it's a creek or creek fed or something like that. They know where to go to find those things.
Mm-hmm.
You'll oftentimes see mason bees, at least in the spring when the adults are out, around mud, because they need mud, hence the name mm-hmm. mason bee, for their nest building and whatnot. So, all right. Well, Tammy tells me that we are on to the phones here with answers to the stumper of how honeybees use water. Jim's up first. Morning, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
What you got?
I'm going, they need it for cleanliness, bathing.
I'm afraid that's not right.
Oh.
That's an excellent guess, though.
All
no.
Right, thanks for the shot.
Yeah, good try. But no, they, you know, the adults don't live very long. And you know, it brings up a question that I never really have addressed that, but there's a fair amount of grooming that goes on. I mean, they comb through themselves to get pollen off their backs and whatnot, so that might inadvertently be part of the cleansing process. But they also groom each other some, so I'm assuming that's how that is. But I'm gonna check with my expert Dewey on that. Find out to do that. Okay, then next up is Ted. All right, Ted.
Hey, I was thinking that water is integral to the creation of the wax for the hive.
Well, nope, that's not a reason either.
Well,
no,
okay.
I mean, You know, all bees need, not all, well, all living creatures need water.
Excellent.
But the larger the creature, the more water it needs. You know, there are some insects that don't drink any water at all, like the silkworm. Gets all of its moisture from eating the, what is it, the
mulberry leaves.
Mulberry leaves, yes, thank you. That's where it gets that. So,
well,
so that's not a major one, but that's another good guess. Gosh, I think these are, you know, right there, and then they take me off on another tangent. Okay, Tim's up next. All right, Tim.
Yeah, hey, Glenn. I,
Tim, you should know.
Well, I don't know if I qualify for the tickets or not, but I can pass on that. But it's, as you and I both know, they oh, by the way, while you were down making pancakes, I went out to water your pans out back, and there must have been hundreds of bees in the various pans that you have moss growing out of.
Yeah.
And very thirsty on the one day that we got up close to 100 degrees. So but
yeah, well, that's a clue right there. Uh-huh. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah, But I'm gonna go to a different answer and say that they use it sort of like inside the hive for cooling the hive, sort of like a swamp fan and the fanning the moisture in there.
That's exactly right. That's one of the reasons, or that's one way that bees use water. They will spread a little film of this water on the top of the cells, or just beads of it around the top of the cells, and then they will pass air over it, setting up with fans fanning their wings to pass a current of air over it. And when water evaporates, it cools, and hence it cools the colony. So Tim, if you want to, okay, Tim, you got dropped, but that's okay. I know Tim, we can put him on the guest list if he wants to go there. Okay. So that's one, to cool the hive. Now, just a little bit of bee biology here, you know, when the queen is laying eggs in mid-January on till about mid-November, 10 months she's laying eggs. So end of January, beginning of February, they've got to keep the hive at a constant temperature to keep the brood alive. That temperature is 92 degrees. You think that's quite a feat when it's 35 outside. And they contract their wing muscles and they generate heat, shivering, kind of like equivalent of our shivering. But what do they do when it's 99 outside and they need to keep that brood at 92 degrees? Well, that's this kind of swamp cooling. So they gather lots of water, will set up a current of air over the top of it, and when it evaporates, it cools the hive. Pretty ingenious there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got the one there, evaporative cooling, as we call that. Okay, Tammy says Steve is up next. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I was about to say evaporative cooling. I have some hives. I work as a beekeeper, and we had to actually provide water in some of our bee yards, especially in the mountains and in the summer.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that was going to be
yours too. Okay. Thanks for calling. It's very important to have water out, you know, because if the bees don't have, this is where I was going, by the way, now that I think of it, if you don't have your water out, then the bees will find some other source, and it could be your neighbor's dog dish, water dog, here's the water, the dog water dish, that's what I'm trying to say, or the kiddie pool, hot tub, you know, so it's very imperative for city beekeepers to get their bees trained to go to their sources of water as much as possible. When you have a lot of bees, of course, they will find many sources. And bees will also gather water from the dew off of trees and in the morning, or rain and things like that. But plus, it's just fun to see them up close there. Okay. No more calls there. Okay, well, we've got the one answer. Now, there's two more here of how bees use water, and we could also throw in this question. The honeybee is the state insect of about how many states? I'm going to say within five. And this is interesting. The honeybee is not native to North America and hence the United States. There is no state insect. There is no native insect that has been named a state insect. Isn't that interesting? What's our state tree? We must have a state tree, probably the Doug fir. Yeah, I mean, that grows here. I mean, that would be like, well, let's say that the, I don't know, sugar maple is our state tree. No, we wouldn't do that because it doesn't grow here, but it might be a, or the, well, anyway. So here's another stumper. If you want to win, would like to be on the guest list for the for this the Ecofilm screening, is within five, how many U.S. states have named the honeybee as its state insect? I'll give you a hint. One of them is Utah.
I would have guessed that.
Yeah.
But that's only one.
That's right. Right. I don't think Jim even knows this.
I don't.
No.
I don't.
Okay. Well, let's talk about pears then. Well, we're waiting for the phones, 503-231-8187. Okay. Yeah, well, let's start broad and narrow it down here. We generally, we talk about, you know, winter pears and then, I guess, what do you call them, summer pears?
Yeah.
Fall pears or
fall
whatever.
Fall pears, sure.
Is there a, do we grow more than one more than the other, at least the homeowner? I mean, the...
I would say most homeowners probably grow summer and fall pears because winter pears are a little more difficult to handle. You can't, you have to wait more longer than you do for the others for them to be ready to eat.
Right. So, although, you know, kind of in my estimation, they're harvested at about the same time. I mean, they're a little bit, the winter pears are harvested a bit later, but so Bartlett is, we'll just use that as the standard for our summer or fall pear.
Yeah.
When do you harvest? What is your telltale sign to? Have you started harvesting?
It's getting close, remarkably close. Usually, I would say first of September, last week of August would be normal ripening. But I'm
that's out there in your place, you know. Yeah. And me in the summer here, I've been harvesting for 3 weeks.
Bartlett pears?
Yep, Bartlett pears. They're dropping off ripe.
Wow, now. They haven't started dropping in our place yet.
Yeah. So the city is different, and this is why we're having this discussion is because if you wait for the pears to drop, it's too late for peak.
Well, if one drops, there's a pretty good chance that the rest are ready to pick. That's also because they don't ripen all at the same time. So so then you can go to the tree and start lifting, which is my way of harvesting. I lift.
Yeah.
As I lift, they come off, and then they're fine.
If when you're lifting, you know, cradle it in your hand and just lift up. If you have to struggle, then don't force it.
No.
And as an experiment one time, I forced one. And in fact, it even took the spur with it.
Uh-huh.
Not a good, the best technique there. But I just did it as an experiment. So I put it with the other ones. Oh, I'm sorry. This was a winter pear that I did it. And let it ripen with the other ones. And we'll get to this, how we would do that. And tasted pretty good.
Yeah.
So even a little early, it was okay.
Well, and commercial orchardists don't wait until they lift and come off because they have to pick them early enough so they can store them. I mean, that's why you can get Bartletts in February, you know, or January, because they pick them early and they test the bricks, the sugar content in the fruit to
see. That's the BRIX.
BRIX, right. And then when they've determined when the bricks, the minimal amount of bricks that will allow the fruit to ripen to acceptable sweetness, that's when they pick it.
So we could do that too as homeowners if we bought a $50 to $400 refractometer.
Yes.
And test the sugar content. I should get one of those just for honey because we like to know what the moisture content is. Or actually it's the inverse, I guess, what the sugar content is. So if the sugar content's high enough, then the moisture content is low enough.
Yeah, it's really an interesting device. We have one, and I try to keep records of various fruits and see what their sugar content is when they appear to be ripe.
And how do you do it with a pear? I mean, just you pick one and then just cut a little slab and
just squeeze the juice onto this little
juice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. You squeeze the juice onto a little metal or a glass plate and then hold that up to the sun. And what you'll see is the refraction of the soluble solids inside the juice, which is the sugar content. And,
uh-huh.
And there's a little scale that shows you from probably 1 to 50 or something, or 30 or something like that.
Well, this, I'm just going off on a tangent here, dirtbag listeners. So if there are different, apples sometimes might be sweet or they might be tart. You know, does the sugar content consistent between those types of apples? Or is there something else that gives it a tartness besides the lack of sugar?
No, the sugar content will be different. Definitely by variety. There's marked differences, but the people who grow these commercially, they've experimented and figured out where the proper Brix content amount to harvest the fruit, and primarily for storage, because the idea is to keep them. I find it somewhat at cross purposes to those of us who really want to enjoy a ripe fruit, but that's why a lot of commercial apples don't have a lot of flavor, because they've been picked too green.
And it's just right there on the cusp, kind of.
Yeah, it's sort of like acceptable, but not prime.
Right. Well, so let's get back to our topic then. Well, what is prime?
Yeah. And prime to me is when, for a pear, most pears ripen off the tree, ripen in the sense that they become ready to eat. And however, Asian pears, for example, are not that way. You pick Asian pears ripe off the tree. They don't ripen off the tree. You have to wait till then. That's one of the tricky parts of handling Asian pears versus European pears, because they can bruise and so forth when they're picked at the peak of ripeness. But a European pear, when it's picked, of course, we pick it when it's firm. I remember when I was a kid, my parents, we had one in our backyard, and a room in our basement where the floor was covered with Bartlett pears, ripening.
I remember Dad would put up a sawhorses with a 4x8 sheet of plywood, and we'd put the pears on there, and I'd go down after school every day and look for the ripest one.
yeah,
that'd great. Be my snack.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's take a musical break. We'll go in. I've got a piece here by Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. It's called Prickly Pear. And then we'll get to our calls afterwards. Of the jazz banjo, Bela Fleck. Okay, let's go to the phones and see if we have some ticket winners, eh? Okay, Jim, you're with the Dirtbag. What do you got for me?
Let's take it Georgia.
What about Georgia? Oh, you're talking about
Yeah, I mean, you asked the question.
Yeah, which state? Well, no, the question I asked is how many states have named the honeybee? Yeah, it's a surprisingly high number, I'll say, have named the honeybee as its state insect. And I said within five.
Let's just say 20.
That's pretty darn close, Jim. You're going to the show.
Oh, good.
If you'd like, stay on the line, and Tammy will take your number and your name, and it'll be on the guest list. Yeah.
All right, appreciate it.
Good guess. 19 okay, states. Thanks, 19 states have named the honeybee as their state insect.
It's a popular bee.
Yeah. Not Oregon. You know what our state insect is, Jim?
No, I don't. Two gems on the floor.
Yeah, that's right. Either one of you guys know. Yeah, the Oregon swallowtail butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
All right, way to go, Jim. Thank you.
Okay, thank you much.
Uh-huh. Okay, so we got that one out of the way. So we're still looking for another way that... we have Eric. Eric's on. Okay, Eric.
Yeah, hi.
You got an answer?
Well, I was going to say 17, but that was wrong.
Well, that would have been right, but you're just too late.
Yeah.
Darn it.
What was the other question then?
Well, how honeybees use water. And we know that the one answer we have is that they use it to cool the hive. But how else do they use it?
To clean things?
No, that was already guessed too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I'm out of luck today.
We'll have more next month because I think there's one more showing in the September. All right. Thanks for calling, though, Eric.
Right.
Okay, back to our... Well, Tammy's still on the phone there. Back to our discussion of pears and how we, one thing that you said during our break there was ubeline is a summer pear that's similar in appearance to Bartlett. They're a pretty good-sized pear.
Big pear. I had over a pound. I picked them this year that were a pound.
Yeah. And Jim said they ripen about a month before the Bartletts do.
Yep.
So in my area, that would be July. And it could have been sometime in early August for you. Well, it's only mid-August now.
Yeah. And one thing neat about ubeline, extremely disease-resistant. That's it was one of those ones we found at the germplasm repository, the plant collection in Corvallis from former Yugoslavia. And amazingly healthy and easy pear to grow.
Uh-huh. And tasty.
And tasty.
It's a little different than Bartlett.
Yeah.
So not interchangeable, but it's a good way to extend the pear growing season.
Yeah.
I remember we had Katie Kolker in here of the Fruit Tree Project a year or two ago. And I think the garden stumper was, or at least I asked her, which fruit was harvested the most. It's essentially a gleaning organization. You can register your trees to be harvested, and then you get some, and then the pickers get some, and then they send some to the food bank, too. I think that's essentially how it works. And pears were by far the most poundage-wise of what they got.
Yeah.
Because pears get pretty good size. You know, there's no real, what I would say, true dwarfing pear. I mean, we call it dwarf rootstock, but that's just because that's the smallest it is.
Right.
But, it's definitely, you know, a fully dwarfed pear will be, you know, 150 to 200% of the size of a pear. I mean, an apple. Excuse me. Okay. Marie. Marie's got to get here so she can get going.
Can you hear me all right?
You betcha. What's your answer?
Okay, my answer is, would the water have to do something with their pollen that they're gathering being made into the honey?
Well, you know, I'm going to give this to you, but it's not really the it's not what you think, because the nurse bees, and this is just a classification of bee that we say inside the colony, and the, what the tasks that bees do is based pretty much on their age. So when a nurse bee does certain tasks inside the colony, and then when it gets older, then it becomes a house bee, and then when it gets older still, it becomes a field bee, the ones that we see. So nurse bees are maybe doing their jobs from 1 day old to 12 days old or something. And one of the things that they're doing is feeding the other bees. And they don't feed them pollen and nectar, but what they feed them is what we call bee bread. And so they eat this pollen and they eat the nectar, and they add microorganisms, bacteria, yeasts, and whatnot, and to make this bee bread, and it comes out of their head, which is, I know, and this is what they use then to feed all the baby bees, whether that's royal jelly for the queen bees or worker jelly for the worker bees or drone jelly, if you will, for the drone bees, the male bees. And they need lots of water to do this. So they're not using necessarily that water to convert their nectar and pollen to honey. In fact, with nectar, they have to evaporate water out of the nectar in order to get it down to honey consistency. So the nurse bees need lots of water, and that's another reason that they would be out collecting it. So, Maria, is it Marie or Maria?
Marie, and I've got a quick, important, short water question about the bees, real short, okay?
Okay, but if you want, I just want to mention that if you want tickets, a pair of tickets, just stay on the line when we're done, and Tammy will take your name.
Okay, I love it. I will.
Okay, quick question.
My quick question is, especially when you explain that yeast and helpful microscopic things are added to the water, so I think it might be important for us Portland people listening to think of how harmful it would be for these bees to have chlorinated water. Ideally, they would have non-chlorinated water.
Yes, except that some of these chemicals are chemicals that we need too. Portland doesn't add just chlorine, it adds chloramine to the water. And I have not seen that to be detrimental. I mean, that's what we're drinking. So I don't know. I mean, it's something to consider, all right. You wouldn't want to, have a bowl made out of pressure-treated wood or something like that, for leaching. But if you had rainwater, that would be good because that can be, that would be great. But, when it's 100 or 99 degrees, boy, rainwater is hard to come by. So, but that's a good point, Marie.
Thank you so much, and I'll wait for the engineer. Thank you so much.
You bet.
A lovely program.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay. Now, back to harvesting pears. Here, the ubelines are early. The Bartletts are coming on now. Mm-hmm. Go out and harvest them. Part of the problem is that you get a lot of pears at once.
Right.
But you can delay the ripening by refrigerating them. So leave some out to ripen up, and it'll take, depending on how close they are, 4 to 7 to 10 days maybe, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, if it's warm weather, it can happen faster than that, five days even.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah. And then refrigerate them and then pull them out as you need them and let them ripen up on the counter at room temperature. But, a lot of us don't have a lot of cold storage space.
Right.
So, hence, we can can them or process them somehow. I can and dehydrate both. And it's kind of fun, but it's a little time-consuming in my busy time. But I like pears in the winter.
Yeah, I know. They're sort of a really great treat.
Well, speaking of then, what about fresh pears all winter?
Right.
We have these winter pears then, and the most common varieties are the Comice. Not too commonly grown here, but the Anjou or D'Anjou is commonly grown here, and also Bosque. Those are kind of the three winter pears. And if they are harvested and stored and ripened correctly, they're like butter.
Mm-hmm.
What I do, and this is just what I've discovered after doing this for 25 years with these pears that I grow, is I'll harvest them generally towards the end of August, and all the Bartletts are harvested by that. But I do have a combination tree that I inherited next door that's a Anjou and a Bartlett. And so I'll harvest all the Bartletts soon, maybe even today I'll do some, and let the Anjou go for another couple of weeks or so. But I'm doing tests, to cradling it and lifting it and see if it breaks away there easily. And when they start doing that, then I'll usually harvest all of them, or maybe I'll break it into two harvests, maybe three, waiting a week or so, because there's some that are just, you got to really pull them to get them off and Wi-Fi it. And I will then, I don't have a huge quantity of these, fortunately, but I'll fill up the crispers in my refrigerator. And I can get a lot of pears in there. They're pretty deep deep crisper drawers, and we'll leave them in for at least a month, cold storage. This really enhances the ripening process, and then pull them out and let them ripen on the counter or whatnot at any time. Ours generally don't last past November, December, because we like them so much, but they would. I mean, if they're in cold storage, and you should check them a little bit periodically to make sure that one's not rotting, because that will spread to the others.
That's right. The rotten pear spoils the crisper.
Boy, I think you're onto something there. And I guess that's all we have to say about pears. Do you want to say anything more about Asian pears?
Well, I think it's important to mention it. I mean, Asian pears are a kind of a different fruit. I mean, they're of the same genus, but they're crisp. They're not buttery, and they're quite juicy. And they, as we mentioned earlier, they don't ripen off the tree. You want to get them fully ripe. And they really benefit from thinning. If you want Asian pears, you've probably seen in the market, some get quite large. I've seen some the size of softballs. Large Korean is one that can get very, very huge. But they get that big through thinning. And so if you have four or five pears in a cluster, you move after they get to be about golf ball size or a little bit smaller, you take off four of them and leave one. Mm-hmm. And then they can get quite impressive.
So you can thin even when they're that large and still have an effect on the remaining one.
Yeah. Yeah, because they get, golf ball, good, yeah. I mean, if you think of a golf ball becoming a softball, that's a magnitude size difference.
Well, I just wondered if the gene process had already been set and no more, doesn't matter how much you're going to do to them. It's like me,
Yeah, I've had that experience.
As big as I'm going to be.
Right. No, I've done it, and I've seen that happen with that size. I mean, it's a little easier you can take them off in marble size. It's probably
Be preferable?
Probably, yeah, even smaller.
So then they're not expending the energy to make them golf ball size.
That's right.
I try to do them when they're smaller.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that works. But I have done it with the golf ball size, and it works too. So they put the energy then into that one remaining fruit and just go to town on it.
Okay, well we'll head into our next break and come back and talk about more. Or if you have gardening questions, you got the number 503-231-8187. And this is a Peter Green song called Greening. And I chose this one because we do not, for Bartlett pears, if they're yellow, they're too ripe. I mean, I would rather see, harvest them when they're green.
That's right. Green pears become yellow pears when they're ripe.
That's right. Peter Green here. Peter Green, song called Greenie. Nice little instrumental there for us. Okay, we got some phone calls, and then we'll get to Jim here. Okay, I've forgotten Tammy. Doug. Okay. Good morning, Doug. You're with the Dirtbag. Hello, Doug. What's on your mind? Ah, oh, we lost Doug.
No, I'm here.
Oh, Doug's there. Okay.
Dealing with my volume and failed to realize this. Forget it. Radio's off.
Okay.
Hello, this is Doug. Okay. When I was traveling a lot a while ago, I used to find a pear tree, pick the pears, put them in apple boxes, each one individually wrapped in its own newspaper.
Yeah.
And I kept the pears until April.
Huh.
Unheated.
Huh. Do you know?
They were in my truck cabin, which I had a little wood stove, but most of the time it was unheated. So I'd heat it up and then would go through it until I found enough pears for me to have for dinner tonight. And usually they just lasted. Four or five boxes, and they'd last all winter.
Well, they were probably winter pears that you were... Can you turn down your radio there?
Well, I don't have the radio on. I
don't know why we're getting an echo. Yeah, that's crazy. All right, well.
They were probably Donjo.
Yeah, that sounds like it was to me, too. We're going to have to let you go, Doug. Somehow we're getting feedback there or an echo there. But that's a good testimony there that if they're stored correctly and he handled them properly there so they wouldn't bruise.
Back in the day, when I lived in Hood River, there was pear packing plants. I mean, it was jobs. You could go and you just pack them in paper. The paper would be impregnated with some kind of chemical, but that's how they packed them. They packed them in paper and store them for the winter pears.
And they still kind of do that. They'll sometimes have a molded cardboard, blue or whatever. It's like cardboard, egg carton material type stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Did we have one more call? Lisa, good morning. You're with the Dirtbag.
Hi there. I just have a really basic question about what time or times of year you should prune your fruit trees. We've got an Asian pear and a combination pear. I got a plum tree. And we've got a bunch of apple trees.
Well, my recommendation is for the pear, the Asian pear and the apple, to do it in the summer if your tree is about the size that you want it to be. If it's not and you want it to get bigger, then prune it when it's dormant, January, February, sometime in that time frame.
So that kind of raises another question. So I'd like these trees not to get so big that it seems like right now they need to be topped. Especially this one red Bartlett. What would be the best time of year to do that?
Well, my rule of thumb for summer pruning is to only make cuts that you can do with a hand pruner.
Okay.
So if the limbs are that small or if you have a real strong hand, you can do it now, according to my rules.
Okay.
But if they're too big, inch and a half or larger, then it's probably best to do those structural cuts when the tree is dormant.
Okay.
And only do, I don't know how big the tree is, but maybe only do a third of what is absolutely needed.
Okay.
I mean, a third of what, I misspoke. I shouldn't have said that. A third of what you want done eventually.
A third at a time.
Yes. And so what I would recommend is you're not going to do any topping, as to use the word that you did. What we want better would be to make a thinning cut. That is to say, stand back 20 feet, look at the tree, see where the tallest branch is, and then follow that down 10 feet if you need to a place where it joins.
Uh-huh.
And cut that off there. Just don't go up and say, oh, I only want the tree this tall, so I'm going to cut off every limb, you know, at 10 feet, and that's it. That will be a recipe for disaster later on.
Okay.
So a thinning cut is pretty descriptive. So okay. It'll open it up, too, in the middle there, too. And maybe you'll need to do that. Maybe you can do two next year and two the following year.
Okay. Super. Thanks very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Okay. Good morning, Chris. You're with the Dirtbag.
Good morning. I bought my fruit trees from Jim out of One Green World, and I bought three pear trees. They're about 5 years old, and they haven't set any fruit yet, and I wanted to know if I'm doing something wrong or is it how long it takes for it, you know, to actually get some fruit going. I've got one Liberty apple that has fruit, and quite a few, actually, really heavy this year. But all the pear trees and the other apples don't have any fruit on them, and I just wanted to know.
Before I turn you over to Jim, okay. Has the pear trees blossomed?
No.
Okay. Jim, he's all yours.
Okay, are the trees vigorously growing? Are they big?
No, they look great. I take very good care of them. I have a nice area underneath them where I put my grass clippings, and I go fishing a lot. I put some of the fish heads and entrails and, you know, water them when it gets dry. And got some chicken manure. I put a little compost there, you know, not over, but just enough to, I think I'm feeding them. They seem to be vigorously growing, and they need to be thinned right now. I didn't catch what the last lady said, but they need to be opened up a little bit. But I do usually every year go in and kind of clean them up. Can I do any of that now? I didn't catch what you were talking to the other lady. Can I do some minor pruning now?
Yeah, okay. Just as long as just hand pruner size.
Right. Okay. But I just wanted to know.
So what is he doing too much, Jim? Loving
them? You know, it doesn't sound right, I suppose, to say this, but you're taking too good a care of them.
And so
what's happening, this is my thoughts anyway, is that the plants are perfectly happy. They're growing vegetatively. They don't need to make any more of themselves. You're just taking such nice care of them that they can wait till flower, till later. So I would probably hold back a bit, you know, maybe cut back on the fertilizing, watering.
I've only fertilized them actually once with the chicken manure, and it was very well composted, and I have a good layer of grass on the top.
Well, the grass can act as a fertilizer, as can the fish entrails.
Right.
I mean, just as a rule of thumb, I never fertilize my fruit trees. I mean, I'll use compost, but well, you know, if they're putting on, you know, 1 to 2 feet of growth, why would I want more?
Okay.
Yeah, water too. Hold back on the water. I have a rule, and I was going to talk about this. We probably don't have much time for it right now, but I would say to people, if you a deep watering once a week is totally sufficient.
I've only watered them twice this whole summer. Uh-huh. When we get a long hot spell like we had, then I'll go out and give each tree a soaking. But normally the rain takes care of it, and the compost, you know, the grass, the mulch.
Fairly,
right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I don't think I'm overdoing it. I mean, they're four or five years old. And, you know, mostly I just put the grass clippings on them. But I also was told that the grass clippings will actually take nitrogen out of the soil to decompose.
Well, if it's right on the surface, that won't be an issue, but it'll add some eventually. So I would...
Okay. In trying to solve your problem, I think what you need to do is to stop fertilizing. And because the plant will bloom. I mean, that's nature tells them to do that. That's how they make more of themselves.
Right.
But I've noticed that, you know, over the years that plants that are growing vigorously and happy will bloom later than those that have a little stress.
And we should say too that pears are not as precocious as apples. That is to say, they don't bear fruit as quickly. You know, pears, apples, 2 to 3 years, you'll get a crop. Pears, you know, 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
So quit adding so many nutrients. You know, we're not going to say fertilize. We're going to say nutrients here.
Okay.
And
next year you'll have flowers.
That's right.
That's not going to be our...
I'll call you guys next year. I'm not going to touch them.
Okay.
Boy, they better be loaded.
Right.
Okay.
Okay,
well,
guys.
Thanks
a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Jim, we're out of time.
I enjoy your show, too.
Great. Appreciate it. All right, Jim, we're going to see you in 2 months, eh?
Yep. I'll be in Russia and Korea next month.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to a
I'll try to call
travel
in.
Log. And
We'll give you 2 minutes for your travel log.
Right.
Not a half an hour. All right. That's it for the Dirt Bag. This is Glenn Andresen. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. And hopefully we'll see you at the Portland Eco Film Series.
And that brings to a close our public affairs programming on KBOO for the morning. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net. Also by Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 41 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March 1st through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, portlandsaturdaymarket.com. Stay tuned, because coming up next is the KBOO Noon News headlines, and then Nick is waiting to bring you Jazz Libs. Thanks for tuning in today. Oops.
This is KBOO.